session number 12713, Mr. Tommy Temple, reel 13.
Mr. T. Temple, reel 13. Under what conditions were you living, Mr. Temple, in Malta?
As I said previously, we went up to Rabat, just outside Rabat, to the estate of the governor's summer residence, which was the palace at the time, was the living quarters for a convent. And we took over part and parcel of the stables in the courtyard with the... I suppose it's the BSLN of the tank corps. But the rest of the battalion were under canvas in the trees further down in the grounds of the palace. Under canvas, not very comfortable, no beds. Well, you couldn't put beds there. Anything that we had to make ourselves or make do with ourselves. Some of the lads were getting wooden boxes from us and making beds out of them, you know. Or if they could get the wicker baskets, they were making beds out of that. They made themselves as comfortably as they could in there, but we never shifted from that area until we left Malta. So that sort of prevailed during the whole course we were in Malta. And incidentally, that was the first time we've ever saw ENSA, because wherever we've been as a battalion in any stationary position, way behind the lines, we've always organised our own entertainment, which we did do on Malta. But lo and behold, one day we got the ENSA show through there, and when we saw it, we said, oh, we'll stick to our own, it's better. But life was going on. We formed our own canteen. A chap called Tavernil was looking after it. And that was further down the valley in a, I suppose it was an old barn of some description, which we had converted down a dirt road. He went down the dirt road and turned into the canteen. The supplies were normal at that stage in Malta. The food, again, we was again handling it through BSL. And I was in charge of rations and NC and ammunition. We're doing nothing with the ammunition at the time, and they're well stocked up.
So had you ceased being a stretcher bearer?
Oh, no. I was specifically sent to BSLN because of the stretcher bearer. They wanted the stretcher bearer, and it was then that I got moved from where I was from A Company into the BSLN for as stretcher bearer. And that was where I got my first stripe. They said, well, if you're going to do the stretcher bearer, you can't just do that. You've got to do something else as well. You'd have to do rations. So they give me a stripe, and I was on Russian NCO on ammunition.
What kind of rations were you having at this early stage?
Well, they were quite normal, Harry. The normal tin stuff, of course, but we were getting fresh beef, fresh vegetables, bread and so forth, done by our own bakery cooks. We were back to, as it were, normal, except for the conditions under which we were living. It was quite good. It wasn't until a later stage that the rationing became very heavy. You know, when the blitz really started, there was no supplies getting in there at all. That was the hard part, it was really hard, there was no question about it. When you talk about soup, which is the main course of the day, it was just a plain vegetable soup with very few vegetables in. It was really rough. Breakfast was neither here nor there, you could whatever you got. But of course, through the contacts I had with this little family that was outside the grounds there, I used to get a couple of eggs every now and again off them, when they could spare them, and I would give them some stuff of ours. Unofficially, they built a sort of fire. They were living in a cave, outside where we were, over the wall, which was the perimeter wall of the governor's estate. There was a dirt road. They were living just across the dirt road into this cave that they found. They'd made it quite comfortable. Or went in for a meal one night, and it was very, very comfortable.
So they'd come from a house.
They'd came from Valletta. Because they were having occasional air raids, but not the sort of stuff which came later on. They wanted to get out away with it, so they found this... during the heavy state of there, the natural fact, there was a bomb fell right outside. It didn't go off. And the little lassie came round and asked for me, and I went around and said, well, what do you want? And she showed me this shell. I said, well, look out of it, everybody. I just took them out and reported it to the Ordnance Corps, and the engineers came out and defused it. And took it away. But this was the sort of thing that was going on all over the, you know, if They had massive places in Valletta and other seaside towns where they could go into underground with these massive underground shelters, but these people just didn't want to do that. They wanted to get out of the way of it at all. And I must admit that we got very, very little in the way of bombs for all that was almost daily. Whichever part of the island you were on, it didn't much, whichever part they were bombing, you could see it. You could see the ACAT going up because we had no fighters. Faith, Hope and Charity, the three gladiators. This was all the defences that we had. We were at the time doing our normal training, but we were training with bicycles this time because of the threat of paratroops, which I suppose on an island where it was very little transport and very hilly and not a room for a lot of motor cars, I suppose it was sensible really, but there we were on just to go on platoon cycling for forages on various, you know, map reading courses as well. We used to do map reading and say, right, we'll go there, we'll go here, but you only went by map reference because this is all we'd give you over the radio or signal, whatever it was, or however we received the information, and they would just give the map reference, and we had to go to that map reference and start the map one up.
In the time that you were there, you started in tents, or most of you started in tents. Did you get into more permanent accommodation?
Never. We were the only people who had permanent accommodation. It was headquarter company, or headquarters and B echelon, which was the quartermaster. So we had to have it because we had to store food in there. And we had to store food, any tin stuff that we got, we had to be constantly turning over, so you were pulling stuff back and putting the new stuff at the back, you know, so that you would get it, the latest date was always coming forward. Well, this sort of stuff had to be kept undercover. Fresh vegetables, of course, they were dished out the day that we got them. We used to go down to the RSC depot and just put our indent in, phone up, say, right, we're coming down for it. What town will it be there, so and so. We used to get on fairly well with them fellas, but it was nearly all fresh stuff at the time. And I suppose, really, the regiment were enjoying this sojourn on fresh food. Fruit, grapes, the usual stuff, you know, that they grow in these places. And it was thoroughly enjoyable. The discipline was less severe than what it was, with you being on active service, you know, right in amongst it all the time. So this was actually, you could have called it, or would have been a rest, but for the blitz that followed us a few months after we got there. We haven't quite an order. In fact, that's where I had my 21st birthday, was on Motla itself.
Did you get involved, or the battalion get involved with defensive works of any kind, or repairing damage, bomb damage?
Yes, in the late stage, when the bombing really started heavy, we had, I think it was two aerodromes. I'm not sure. One was Lucca, which is now the main airbase, the airport for Malta. And the one, a fighter base, which is up by where we were, Tikali. Again, there was no such thing as Air Force regiments in those days to do aerodrome defence. So each battalion that was there had to take a section of it. And during the heavy bombing, of course, we were employed mainly in Tikali and Lucca, building repairs, steamrollers, for all we had in the engineers were doing that sort of thing when we were getting rubble and filling the bomb holes in. And it's honest to say that as the bombs were falling, we were filling them in another part of the aerodrome. I say we, I'm talking about the regiment, because I wasn't there at the time. I was still up the Via della Palace in the comparatively safety. Although I wasn't safe there either, because we did get one raid at night, unfortunately, where they must have known we were there. Because they didn't drop any high explosive bombs. They were APs, anti-personnel. And we had quite a number of blokes hit. You know, the bomb, I suppose, would be about a foot long. It would just explode in the air. Some of them fell to the ground, dud. And this is how we found out that there were APs. That was the only one we raided, apart from fighter, machine gun fire. This is where I told you there's another experience of a lad getting wounded. He was manning a twin Bren on its mounting outside on the tennis courts. We were adjoining that. And during the course of one day, the semi came over a bit low, so took a short cliff. He just let go of fly at it, you see, and he said, come back in. He said, feel that again there, Tony. Smashing. He said, I think I've put some holes in it. I said, oh, good lad. Did he come down? He said, no, but he's got... I got a couple of his ass as he went over. And we went out the next time to see how he was getting on when the next one came over. And he said, oh, I've got a stiff shoulder, Tony. Can you, or Shirley it was, can you do anything with it? And I said, ah, however, put the gun away. He dropped his gun and reload, put two fresh magazines on the top, you know, because they were twins. And took him inside and I took his jacket off. And they said, oh, yes, you've got a bullet wound. I can't do nothing with that. I'll put a dressing on. And he said, do I have a look at the other one? Because I think I've got one in there as well. He had one in his shoulder. Again, one of those things which he asked me previously, the reaction of people getting wounded, he said, I've just got a sore shoulder. There was no such a thing, and they're screaming out. I said, that was it. No hysterics, no nothing, quite casually. I've got a sore shoulder. He bandaged the two up, put a tab around his neck, and right away to send him to the... Because the aid post then was right in the courtyard where we were. So I took him along and I just passed him over to Dave Milligan, mate of mine. I said, you got one in each shoulder. He said, oh, we'll tell you how to look. He said, oh, we'll just send him where he is. Just got in an ambulance and he went to hospital. But again, this is one of those things where you see the heroics on the field, on the films, you know. I never found it like that at all. He didn't drop anything, you know, and start yelling, oh, my shoulder, fold up and start curling up in pain and agony. It's all done for to entertain the public on films. But it's not quite to entertain my mind, I must admit.
Were there many casualties in the time that you were there?
Yeah, we had a few, mainly due to bombing or machine gunning by aircraft. We were getting fed up with it. You know, we had the similar sort of thing as this in Malta, in Tobruk. We just sort of said, oh, damn, here, this is one of the times, I think, where the morale started flagging a bit. Haven't got out of Tobruk, you know, and spent a year or two in the desert chasing up and down. And you come here for a rest, and then it starts, you say, oh, here we go again, sort of thing. But nevertheless, they got on with it. They didn't. The only thing that they didn't like, of course, was the shortage of food. And this went on and on. They were working. We get to get some news through that they were going to send some Spitfires out to us. No, they came out from aircraft carriers, so I'm told. But they landed on Malta, but Jerry, with his Air Force, I mean, he was only in Sicily, 60 miles away. Well, he must have picked them on the radar long before they ever got anywhere near Malta, and he was short of bombs, sending the bomb raids over. And as they were landing, of course, the bombs were dropping. We'd built, in preparation for the horizon, we'd built out of sandstone, mind I say, solid sandstone. It took like a dozen blokes to move one, you know, and we built what we called sangars for them, so that the whole aircraft could go inside there with a net over the top to camouflage them completely. All they'd done was fold the net back and wheel them out when they were ready. Those spitties didn't last all that long, and it was some time after that they decided they would send more over. But instead of sending them over with the extra fuel tanks, they sent them over without it, but the aircraft carriers came in closer with a heavier escort. They came in closer so they could arrive fully equipped and armed, which the first lot weren't because of the underground tank, the underwing tanks. This was the problem. When they landed on Malta, they had to be refueled and armed. And the RAF blokes, for all the work, I mean, they did some really hard graft. There wasn't any question about it. But they couldn't keep pace with it. So we more or less lost that lot. One or two were salvaged. But the second time they'd done this, they said, right, we'll get the aircraft carriers nearer. And the next lot, of course, came, were armed, and they were able to stay over the island for, I think it was about half an hour before having to come down. And they were in various flights, of course, when Jerry came. Well, we thought the same thing was going to happen. Oh, what a shock he got. And didn't he hightail it home when they were all coming in there and the Spitz were chasing them? Oh, they just scattered them. Well, that gave us that little bit of respite for them to come down. RAF blokes grabbed them. We were helping them with the carrying the stuff, you know, and rearming and putting the ammunition boxes in, helping them. We helped them as much as we could and as much as we knew how. And they were ready for takeoff as soon as the air in shouted. They were off and away again, and it was great to watch them. Absolutely great to watch. But those three gladiators, faith, hope and charity.
How did you relate to the civilian population? Was that they were obviously going through a hard time?
Well, I think much the same as us. They were fed up with it, you know, when it was getting towards the end. But up until the time that we gained mastery of the air again, and things got much easier when the ships started coming in from both Gibraltar and from Alexandria, you know, for new supplies and from Tobruk. very much the same. They were on starvation diets just as much as we were. I mean, I lost a couple of stone there, and I wasn't the fellow that was doing the heavy work. The blokes who were doing the heavy work must have obviously lost more. But because they were supremely fit, and because they'd been reasonably well fed in the past, they could withstand it. We had a couple that flaked out. In fact, there was one instance where they were working during the heat of the summer, and it can get really hot in Malta. The blokes were flaking out left, right and centre, and Jock Lees, there again, old medical officer, he said, well, he couldn't understand it because they were all getting on the same. It just seemed as though that everyone sort of decided to flip out altogether. It was too much of a coincidence, and Jock went down to the edge room and had a look round, examined the blokes, and it suddenly dawned on him. Salt. They're sweating and they're not putting the salt back. So he had a barrel of salt put at each place where the blokes were working. And as they were just having a nip of salt every now and again, and they seemed to pick up the salt was being put back into the bloodstream again. So Jock did a good job of work there.
Were there any other illnesses which the men
suffered? Well, as again, we were a superb unit for physical fitness. I think this again must have been, of course, due to the supervision of the officers and the WOs and sergeants, keeping us, as we thought at the time, here we go again, like, being buggered about. But looking back, you can understand why now. And the state of physical fitness, I don't suppose there was any... I would have matched them against any commando unit. They were really hard men, really hard men. Even the blokes who were reinforced from other regiments, like the Welsh Regiment, the Essex, and one or two others... they were all absolutely superbly fit. I think it was only that they managed to withstand the rigours of Malta. And it was rigours. Well, how we got on fairly well with the people that on the island. I say this couple that this family that was outside the palace, we got on very well with them, Dave Milligan and I. They used to invite us over for what little bit they could afford, like, you know, and as I say, they would come round and one of the girls would say, well, Mum and Dad, won't you come over tonight for a meal? And she said, well, what have you got? And we'd give them a little bit, knowing that Dave and I were going to get some of the food, so we'd maybe just give them a tin of bully or a piece of beef if it was left over. And no bread, they used to do their own, give them some flour that used to make what they wanted. But basically speaking, we got on fairly well with the Maltese.
Do you remember the name of the family?
Camilleri. Man Pa Camilleri.
So there was no problem between the men and the civilians?
No, none at all.
Was there much chance for girlfriends to be taken up?
Yeah, some of the lads used to take a girlfriend up. Their parents frowned on it, mind. They didn't want it because half the time Malta is a Roman Catholic island, no question about it, and the majority of our blokes were all Protestants, Church of England, Church of Scotland, or whatever it was. But they used to take up, but nothing serious. I don't think it was anything ever serious. We knew that we weren't going to be there very long. We reckoned on a couple of years at the most, but we were only there about 18 months eventually, as things happened. And there was one instance, I remember, the First Army had done the invasion of North Africa to match up with the advance of the Eighth Army. On the eastern side, on the eastern front. They had advanced for so far long and they got stuck by this fortress that could only be tackled from the sea. Well, it was decided, I don't know who by, but it was decided that the Durhams would go in destroyers and front this, do an assault from the sea, with the Navy giving us the cover from with their guns and us going in with rowing boats from the Navy, as it were, or landing craft. And four men were picked out to attach Bangalore torpedoes to the gates that were holding it. Once we'd landed, we had to get, further forward, get onto forward. And these blokes, they were already marked down for VCs. There wasn't any question about it. And at the last minute, we were all the way down to the dockside. No carriers, just your small arms, machine, old Bren guns and so forth. It was going to be a hard job. And the echelon hadn't moved, but the rest of the company were on the way down and it was suddenly called off. Somebody realised it was going to be a complete waste of time. and it should never have happened to have been ordered in the first place. And whether it was the High Command had intervened at some... So I think some silly bugger must have thought of the idea was going to soften it up for them to come through on a soft scale, you know, so they had nothing to do but to go forward. But it would have just thrown a whole battalion away, a regular battalion like that. So they saved us for Greece instead. So that one was called off anyway. But getting on with the Maltese people, we found that they were generally good people, easy to get on with. I can't tell you about other regiments, because I don't know what the Irish Fusiliers, it was one of the regiments, the King's Yorkshire, King's Regiment. That was another Yorkshire regiment. There was another one. There was four regular battalions, another force regular battalion, formed a brigade when Malta was declared, when we were eventually relieved, as it were.
Did you have any scares of German Italian invasions or parachutists?
No, we had no parachutes. We were well prepared for them. As I say, we were constantly doing these exercises with bicycles, so we could mobilise ourselves fairly quickly. We had no parachute. There was one scare of two Italian mini submarines landing on a part of the island, but we just sent a patrol over and collared them in. But it was nothing really. The only thing that was the air. This is what they were really frightened of. I don't know why he didn't drop paratroops. I really don't. I don't know how somebody made a mistake, but they didn't make the same mistake on Crete. Doing it on Crete. Malta was a much smaller island, I must admit. You're only talking about 9 by 18 miles. 9 miles, 8 miles long, 9 miles wide. It's widest point. They still could have done it, I suppose. But mind, it was a very rocky island. They would have had a rough passage because we were at any given point in our area in designated area within 10 minutes. And we could see them coming quite clearly. The fact that there was always watchful transport planes. We knew that the 88s were coming over and the Stukas and the fighters, the 109s, but we always used to watch for the big, but never approached it. I can never understand why they didn't do it. There was, I think we would have managed, but dependent on how many they dropped, Harry.
Had the command of the battalion changed?
At that stage, Scouty Arden was still with us. I don't think John Kirby took over the battalion at that stage. I think it was just after that we lost Colonel Arden, and he was to go in charge of an Indian brigade. I'm sure it was an Indian brigade. And then John Kirby was took over command of the battalion. And I think Hugh Vokes at that stage stepped up to second in command. He was then major, but I think he stepped up to second in command.
Where did you go after this?
Well, we went back to Egypt.
Same kind of journey?
Similar journey, only it was much more in convoy, fairly hefty convoy. I think they were coming through from Gibraltar to go to Alexander. We just tailed on them as they came past Malta. They weren't in Malta. And it was funny enough, they were still doing convoy duties and escorts and so forth, because there were reports of a couple of enemy submarines operating in the Med at the time. And we were just changed course this morning, around about breakfast time. I think it was about the second morning we were out. And we just heard this dull thud and somebody shouted, there's a ship going down. Well, we all dashed up top. And it was just at that point where the whole convoy had turned to go onto a zigzag. And it must have just missed our arse end. I don't know why, but it caught a merchant ship on our other side, on the starboard side of us. And he went down about 2 minutes flat. No bother at all. Must have caught really midships.
Did you watch this?
Yes, we were watching it. It was rather pathetic, really. It was so clear that you could see the officers when they were struck. He came down from the bridge, and he had his cap on that time. He took his cap off, put it inside his shirt, fastened his shirt, and just dived over the side. And others who weren't so fortunate were actually running up towards the front of the vessel. The prow of the vessel. In actual fact, when it started going down, because it went down stern first, they were actually standing on the top and diving off. It went down so quickly, they had so little time to get out of it. And that was when the Commodore, the convoy, signaled that one of the destroyers should stay there and rescue what he could, pick up what passengers. The general drill at that particular time, from what I can gather from the Navy, was when that happened, the escorting ships, the convoy would just go on, the escorts would go on. The escorts who were behind that would drop nets over the side so that they would slow down as we were going through the passage so that blokes would grab onto them and up they would go. But one destroyer was told to stay behind and stop engines. Get that guy, the old cost, get him, because it might cost a lot more of their shipments, which he did do. As soon as the submarine started up again, anyway, he joined us again before we got to Alexander. Well, it was about 5 or 6 hours after the torpedo.
Must have worried you, though, seeing a ship torpedoed going down in the sea.
Naturally, I think it was that we didn't think much about it at the time because we hadn't thought that there was any more submarines left in the Med. But when that happened, there was very few people who went down below decks after that. You always see them on the top. Bit difficult for the management of the ship, I suppose. We have about 600-700 blokes on board, and they got through it all right. We got to Alexander safe enough, no problem really. That was the only problem that we had. Nothing to us.
What ship were you travelling on?
Again, memory, Harry. I can't remember.
It was a troop ship.
We had the usual things, hammocks, done between decks. Quite comfortable things to sleep on, really. Once you've got the movement of the sea never affected you with the hammock. It didn't matter which way it was because the hammock always stayed still. I mean, the ship would be going all sorts of way, but the hammock used to stay still because it was suspended at two ends. I thought it was a comfortable place to sleep. But a lot of the lads used to sleep on the floor. Said, "No, I'll sling the hammock." I knew how to get into it. They didn't.
So we only got to Egypt. What happened to you then?
Again, we start. I think it was some leave again. We always seem to go to these places from leave, and then again we started training. Once the leave was over, I think majority of the time just stayed on about the Alex area. We went down to Geneva again, the base depot, and a lot of them went back to Alex to get a good look at the place and the surrounding area. And after the leave was finished, we came back together again. We didn't get re-equipped because we'd lost nothing. We just started Soviet invasion training at various places throughout the Middle East, doing mountain warfare again in the Lebanon. Dry shod training. We went into Israel, one part of which is now Israel, that was Palestine, right out in the desert somewhere, in tents. And they had these miniature, well, they weren't miniature, they were corrugated iron vessels on dry land in the sand. Exactly as it were, a land from a landing craft assault, because this was the type that an infantry would have to use. We tore about 3 weeks, I think, we were in that place, just doing nothing else, absolutely boring, dead boring. Doing nothing else but the sound of the whistle, drop the hatch, drop the bridge type of front mountain, and out and as fast as you could. We used to clear that at the end of the day, at the end of I think it was 3 weeks we were there. The end of 3 weeks, it took us about 9 seconds to get the whole platoon out, which was fairly good going. But as I say, with the training with our battalion, it really was first class. You had blokes who knew what they were doing. Not that they'd experienced before, but they knew what was wanted, and they used to put it into practice and make sure that we all put it in. They used to do it as well as us. So whatever we done, they done. Whatever they done, we done. And as I say, we used to clear this in about 9 seconds flat. And when the CO was quite happy that, would carry on until somebody said, right, oh, you're going somewhere else. And we went to, again, off the Bitter Lakes, where we'd done the real ambush from ships, proper ships this time, based in the canal zone, actually on the Bitter Lake itself, the larger of the two. And there were the Glen Campbell, I think, we were operating from, where you got the actual physical experience of, given sound, probably the hooter of the ship would sound. And from that, whatever you were doing, you had to go to your battle stations, put your equipment on, and hell for your landing craft position. And again, we were the fastest one that's ever been known that was in that particular area of time. We used to clear that ship in about 5 minutes flat. And within 10 minutes, we were actually on the beach. And we'd done that sort of training for, I think it was another 3 or 4 weeks when we were actually doing that. And the flap that was going on at the time, or the story that was going on at the time, it was going to be Rhodes. But we didn't know. And it was at this stage where the troops had landed in Sicily and Italy. They were putting up. We thought we might have gone over to them, but they said no. And there was talk about the front opening on on France or the Netherlands, somewhere on the other, and within Europe itself, you know, on the Channel side. But lo and behold, the Italians packed up all together, and we were shipped out on destroyers to go to the Dodecanese.
Do you recall the date?
This was in the September, just after my birthday. I remember it was 4th of September.
1943.
About then, Harry. 43, about then. Yeah. Yes, it was about then. Round about the date of my birthday, anyway. I think I'm almost sure it was the 4th of September. And we landed in Leros, which was the larger of the islands occupied by the Italians. And then we were shipped by Greek Kaikis, a large Greek Kaiki, to Kos. That was an eventful journey as well. We ran aground, didn't we? So this is we had to get the all troops to go to the stern of the vehicle, get down to the back. Everybody take your equipment, take everything down with it, try to get the prow, as it were, the stem of the ship shifted. We got off anyway. We got off and got into the small harbour at Kos. And from there, the Italian were just split up into various companies and went to various parts of the island, took over the Italian places, positions.
Where were you?
I was with, again, with the echelon, being stretcher bearer and Russian and ammunition again, in that role. And we were just sitting around the main harbour. There was a small school there, just away from the harbour. We were in that school. That was our little patch, our little headquarters. Italian headquarters was further into the town itself. And that's a fact they called the name, at that stage, the name of the town was Koo. They spelled Koo. Quite a pleasant little island, really. Very pleasant. We were supplied in the main by air with D-52s, D-47s, D-52s, who were flying down the Turkish coast and then cutting across and landing on Kos itself.